Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. This Sunday marks the 75th anniversary of the United States Naval Construction Forces, more commonly known as the Seabees. Although the relatively small unit has played a vital role in America's military operations around the world, many people have never heard of them. SDPB's Jim Kent sat down with some Seabees who were trained to build and to fight and shares this story.
If you're a World War II film buff or a John Wayne fan, you've probably seen The Fighting Seabees. The 1944 movie offers a somewhat accurate depiction of the U.S. Naval Construction Forces.
Mr. Donovan had a construction job on the island when the Japanese attacked, sir. Most of his crew were killed.
Yes, I know.
If these men had been in uniform, they might still be alive. And I submit, sir, that every day this war makes more and more demands for construction under combat conditions. Airfields, roads, beachhead installations. I'd like to suggest the raising of a model basic unit, large enough to include the specialists and machinery to do any kind of a job. Say 1,000 men, sir. Self-contained, self-sufficient. A battalion. A construction battalion.
Chuck Kubik retired as commander of the Seabees in 2005 after 35 years in the service and wrote a book about his time with the Navy's construction forces.
I think the movie you mentioned depicts it very well, and the Seabees then became an integral part of both the Marine Corps island-hopping campaign, as well as Seabees participated in amphibious landings at D-Day and ultimately did the pontoons that helped Patton cross the Rhine.
Kubik notes that the unit's primary role was to create infrastructure wherever it was needed.
Absolutely. That's where we got our motto, we build, we fight. And so we were basically created from the construction trades. In many cases, people were pulled from civilian jobs. The average age of the Seabee in World War II was 37, where the average age of the Marine was 19. And so the standing story was, be nice to the Seabees, he could be some Marine's father. So they were generally older, but they were skilled in construction, and then they had to be trained to fight as infantry.
The Seabees served throughout the Pacific and European theaters during World War II and never looked back. They went on to provide construction support during the Korean War, and in 1955 began deploying yearly to Antarctica to build and expand scientific bases there. The first group of 200 Seabees distinguished themselves by constructing a 6,000-foot ice runway on McMurdo Sound in spite of a raging blizzard. Located on Main Street in downtown Rapid City sits the Veterans of Foreign Wars Post 1273. I'm here to meet two more former Seabees. Dick Turnwall was born in Aberdeen, South Dakota. He grew up on a farm, but tilling the soil wasn't in Turnwall's blood, so he joined the military to see what else the world had to offer.
I was a Seabee, I was an equipment operator, and then I was also a U.S. Navy diver. And I was in the U.S. Navy from 1968 to 1998.
No sooner had Turnwall joined than the 19-year-old found himself in Vietnam.
We're in a war zone. You not only have to build things, you have to be able to defend yourself and protect what you're building. So we have a lot of weapons qualifications that goes along with being a Seabee.
Rifles, grenade launchers, machine guns, you name it, the Seabees qualified for it. And it wasn't long after his arrival in Nam that Turnwall was putting that weapons training to use. But he says the Seabees were generally safer than others in the combat zone.
We would work out on the roads that were off of our camp. So we weren't out beating the bush like the Army and the Marines. We were building things. So every night we were in a camp. A couple of times we'd get mortared at night, but much safer than some of the folks that were the grunts.
Not so, fellow South Dakotan and Seabee Roger Anderson, who enlisted a few years earlier than Turnwall and found himself right in the middle of the Tet Offensive.
How was that?
No fun. Lost some friends. When I first got there, I was on security, so I ran the 81 mortars for the battalion. I did that for 3 months, and then I transferred to out to the Rock Crusher. I think there was 26 of us Seabees and about 100 Marines around the Rock Crusher, and then guarding the bridge at the river, which usually got blown up, and then they'd put pontoons floating you back and forth. But we came under attack several times at the Rock Crusher because we were so small.
But Vietnam was only a small part of Anderson's career, and like Dick Turnwall, he traveled the world for years doing what he loved to do best, building. Asked why the public generally knows so little about the Seabees, Turnwall replies because it's a small unit, they're frequently deployed overseas, and their only main bases are in Mississippi and California.
There's only about 10,000 active duty Seabees, so it's a real small group. So we kind of get forgotten about that way because of the size. It's probably one of the best kept secrets the Navy's got.
Dick Turnwall and Roger Anderson both enjoyed their CB careers, so much so that they each would have stayed in past their retirement. But there are other men and women carrying on the CB's traditions that Turnwall, Anderson, and the thousands before them carved into the Navy's history beginning in 1942. And as Roger Anderson points out, they may be known as the fighting CB's, but their first job is to build. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jim Kent.
CBs from South Dakota and Wyoming will gather at an anniversary dinner in Rapid City on March 4th. For more information, go to listen.sdpb.org. Welcome back to In the Moment. SDPB's Nate Weck returns today. We look beyond the madness of March to hear the story of a South Dakota high school ball player with big talent and a big presence on the court. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Lori. How are you doing today?
I'm all right. I'm up here at the University of Sioux Falls. Nate is down at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion. And we're all together now talking about basketball. And Gary Ellenbolt is out calling a game somewhere, I think.
Yeah, Gary will be in Huron for the Class B tournament, which starts a week from today, actually, is when all the action for the state tournaments gets going. So, a lot of exciting stuff.
He's prepping. All right. So, who do you want to introduce us? It's going to be a big picture, and lots of brackets are taped up on the doorways in the office there. But behind every bracket is a real story of real high school kids getting the job done. Who are we going to meet this week?
Yeah, a few weeks ago we met a girl by the name of Chloe Lamb from Sully Buttes. There's another girl in the state from Sanborn Central Woonsocket for the Blackhawks team there. Her name is Maya Selland. She's a senior for that squad, and they're hoping to also make it to the state tournament for Class B. They'll find out their fate tomorrow night when they play DeSmet in Madison, South Dakota. The winner of that game goes to the state tournament. And there's a lot of talent. Like you said, Lori, there's a lot of brackets, people looking at the brackets, people looking at the scores. But we like to dive into that a little bit more and not even just look at the stats, but look at the stories of the players and the participants on these teams. And that's what we did with Maya Selland. Josh Kapler and I went to Forestburg, South Dakota. If you've never been to Forestburg, South Dakota, it's in between Mitchell and Huron. If you're heading towards Huron, you'll see it, and you almost will miss it because the green sign that says Forestburg, South Dakota is actually posted onto a tree. So if you ever go to that area, Sanborn Central High School is right there when you come into the town. It's pretty much right. If you're going through Forestburg and you know what Forestburg is, you know exactly where Sanborn Central High School is.
All right, so Maya is one of those kids that started playing ball early.
Yeah, she really did. She started playing as a seventh grader for the varsity squad, and it was actually the first year, too, that Sanborn Central and Woonsocket co-opted together to create the Sanborn Central Woonsocket Blackhawks basketball program. So it was the first year of the co-op, so all she's ever known is that co-op. She's never been a part of Sanborn Central as it was the Sanborn Central Rebels, but she's been a part of it ever since it's been Sanborn Central Woonsocket. So this is her sixth season playing on the varsity squad, and you know that right there, 6 years playing with a varsity squad. I mean, and being a senior, you think she's going to have to miss it a little bit too, because for the last over half a decade, I mean, that's what she's known.
Yeah. So, what kind of girl is she?
She's very humble. That was, I think, the thing that Josh and I, when we were interviewing her, really took note of right out the gate is how humble she is, because she talks a lot about the team and how all of her accomplishments wouldn't have been possible without her teammates. Earlier in February, Maya Saland joined a small group of individuals, joined the 2,000 point club. So she has 2,000 points in her career. Even 1,000 points is a pretty big milestone in high school basketball here in South Dakota. So to have 2,000 points, I mean, you're talking about a person that can seriously score the basketball. But the thing about her and sitting there and watching practice and things like that too, she's not afraid to share the basketball. You know, if there's an open shot for her, obviously she's going to take it, but she's very good at defense. She's very good at passing the ball and finding teammates and just trying to find the best. She's one of those players that when she's on the court, you're going to have a better chance to win the game.
So, Nate, I don't follow basketball a lot. I'm learning, as many South Dakotans are, as I go here. Let's talk a little bit more about this 2,000-point benchmark. How rare is it? What you got to stay healthy, I'm guessing, and you also have to have a great team. Maybe, I don't know. Tell me, you know, what all goes behind 2,000 points in basketball?
Yeah, I think when people hear 2,000 points, they think, oh, man, they must be a great player, which is true. But you have to have the correct situation to have a milestone like that, too. Like Maya said, and like you had stated, too, Laura, you got to have the ability. You have to have team success, because you're not going to have the opportunities to score points if you're on a team that isn't getting those opportunities to score, because you have to have teammates that set you up in position. And if you have other people on the court that can also score points, the defenses aren't going to be able to just zone in on that one player. They're going to have to actually play defense and defend all five people that are on the court. So for Maya to have 2,000 points, it's a very big deal. It's a big deal for her, but it's also a big deal for the school, because the community, too, rallies around that. And for her to have 2,000 points, it's kind of like when Abby Hora had 2,000 points last year for Viberg Hurley. When she had 2,000 points, the whole team kind of felt like they had that 2,000 points, like they were a part of that because of you know, she's not going to, you know, if it's not, Maya can't do it all by herself. And I've stated that, and you got to be in the right situation, but it is rare. And typically the players that do put up those types of numbers are players that can go on to the next level. And Maya Salen next year will be going up to play with a fellow South Dakotan, Macy Miller, up at South Dakota State with the Jackrabbits women's team up there. And they're a very good women's basketball program in D1 college ball. So she's going to a program that's arguably one of the best mid-major colleges in the nation.
All right, if you're just joining us, I'm talking to Nate Weck about basketball. He's introducing you to Maya Saland. And Nate, when I said I don't know much about it, I'm kind of learning, maybe that's an anomaly in this state, because there's a lot of support for basketball. Tell me about her community and how they support her.
Yeah, the community of Sanborn Central really does get behind it. And, you know, we talk about how passionate South Dakotans are for basketball, because it's not just high school, it's not just college. It seems like even at the middle school level, people are so passionate about the sport of basketball in the state of South Dakota. And Maya also mentioned on that, and she said that it's very true as well for Sanborn Central and the community, that they too are just as passionate.
We can go to away games and we'll have more fans in the stands than the home team, you know, so it's pretty neat to kind of have that support, especially just here in the high school level, to have fans that really care about you. And, you know, they obviously want you to play well, they want you to win, but at the end of the day, you know, if you don't get the win, they're still going to love you no matter what. So I think that's also something that's kind of unique about our community too.
So let's talk about this community that she's from, because Sanborn Central Woonsocket, you alluded to it earlier in our conversation, Nate, this is a co-op.
It is. It's about 25 miles northwest of Mitchell. And it's one of those country kind of communities type of thing. And you've got Sanborn Central High School that's right there in Forestburg, plus you go 8 miles farther west and you enter the town of Woonsocket. And there's, you know, then you have country kids too from the area too that are also a part of the program. And the coach even mentioned to us too, and we were sitting there kind of watching practice, he had kind of mentioned too, he goes, you know, our basketball program was okay, but you know, when we started this co-op with Woonsocket, our basketball program, especially with girls basketball, got really good. And you start looking, you go to the gym and you look at the banners and you go, okay, 2012, 2013, 2014, 2016. Yep, they were at the state tournament all of those years. And I think it's, you know, because when they went with the co-op, positive things happened and they were able to get more players to participate. And when you get more players, you're going to have a better chance of getting more talent as well. And that's just kind of the truth of the scenario. Maya talked about the aspect of having a co-op, and there has been some negative conversations that have taken place in the state of South Dakota about co-ops, because for some communities it's very tough. Luckily for Sanborn Central and for Woonsocket, co-op's a little bit easier because of how close the communities are. And Maya also had a few comments about the positive aspect that she sees in her area with that co-op.
Co-ops are just neat because I think we all have our small towns and we're kind of rivals with everyone else. And then you get to, you know, have the co-op and the towns get together, and then you kind of realize we're all kind of the same. We all like to do the same stuff, and so it's just cool. You kind of have maybe more sport because, you know, we're a lot of communities here thrown together at Sanborn, and then you have Woonsocket and those communities, and so it's just a big group of communities coming together for, you know, like one cause. They all come to support Blackhawks. And so I think that's really neat.
All right, Nate Weck, that's Maya Sandlin. You've got Chloe Lamb's feature up on Facebook as well, right?
Yep. So we're going to do a similar thing with Maya Sandlin, which we did with Chloe Lamb. We produced a digital short piece that's also going to air during the state basketball championships. We have the Chloe Lamb one done. It's published. It's ready for viewing pleasure. It's on our Facebook page, SDPB Sports, and we'll have the Maya Sandlin one available looking around next Wednesday before the basketball tournaments get going. So both of the pieces will be on our Facebook page, and they're all, yeah, the Chloe Lamb ones are already ready to view, and the Maya Sandlin one will be up in a week.
All right, SDPB's Nate Weck. Thanks, Nate.
Thanks, Lori.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Since January of this year, sales of George Orwell's classic dystopian novel 1984 have surged by more than 9,000%. The publishing house Penguin has announced plans for a special 75,000 print run of a book that's 70-some years old. So what's all the fuss about? Patrick Hicks is writer in residence at Augustana University and one of our favorite ongoing guests. He's the author of numerous books, including the short story collection, The Collector of Names, and the novel, The Commandant of Lubezeck. He joins me now in the studios at the University of Sioux Falls to discuss the timeless influence of George Orwell. Patrick, thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's wonderful to be back.
All right. So those numbers surprise you?
Sorry, go ahead.
The spike in sales and a 75,000 print run of 1984. What's going on?
You know, it did surprise me at first, and then it makes total sense in sort of retrospect. But it surged to number one on Amazon in late January. And I just checked a couple hours ago, and it's the 18th most bought book on Amazon right now.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's clearly enjoying a revitalization.
I didn't check back on this, but I'm wondering now when 1984 rolled around, what its numbers were, because we were all reading it back then, and now we're all reading it again. So if you haven't read it and haven't had time to check out the Spark Notes this morning like I did, because it's better for yours. I couldn't remember the main protagonist's name, but gosh, I remember those rats. So
everyone remembers the rats, yes.
So give us an overview of the plot of George Orwell's classic.
Sure thing. Well, it was written towards the end of Orwell's life. His real name is Eric Arthur Blair, and he was born in 1903, and he was really born into great wealth and power in the British Imperial State. And he really turned away from what he had been born into. And towards the end of his life, you know, he was writing things like Animal Farm, which came out very shortly before 1984 did. He wrote 1984 in 1948, so that's possibly why it's called 1984. He just transposed the numbers, and it was published in 1950. But it's a novel about a variety of things. It's a dystopian novel that takes place, well, in the future at that point in time and in the past for us now. And it involves a main character named Winston Smith. And the world is divided into three empires. You have East Asia, Eurasia, and Oceania. Observation is constant. There's cameras and TV screens in every room. And it is illegal to question Big Brother. And if that is done, it's considered a thought crime. There are public executions. People disappear in the middle of the night. And you're monitored constantly. There's this a new way of speaking called Newspeak. And old speak is not outlawed, but it's hard to find people that will speak that. And Newspeak is designed to eradicate the ability to think critically.
It's a whopper of a tale. Was there anything like it? Just very quickly, define
sure.
dystopian for those who aren't into literary genres, so we're all on the same page.
Yeah, no, and thank you for that. Well, utopian literature started like in the 1500s with this idea that you would create a new society, and certainly that was something that was very popular with early American fiction. The idea you'd have these European settlers coming here and believing that they could establish some sort of utopia, and a dystopian form of literature is something that was really very popular in the mid 20th century, in particular between the years 1930 and about 1960. And if you think about this dystopian, an anti or a negative utopian literature, and you think about the history of the 20th century, it makes sense why this would become popular. So. What I mean by that is we have George Orwell, who was born in 1903, and as a boy, he's growing up with the slaughter on the fields of France and in Belgium in World War I, the catastrophic industrialized slaughter of World War I, which left 25 million people dead. And then we have the Spanish flu in 1919, which kills around 30 million people. And then we have Stalin's Russia. We have the catastrophic collapse of the American economy. And I haven't even gotten to World War II yet.
Right.
And we're already looking at the death of millions of people. So this idea of a dystopian literature is born out of the hopelessness that the 20th century seems to bring about.
So 1950 is when it's published.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of the 50s as sort of a jubilant time, but maybe not that early. Or is it, a message during a time in America of a greater, resurgence of happiness? Or
yeah, and the 50s I think are certainly that way for the American imagination. Certainly, if you're white American, the 50s are, they recall some sort of nostalgia there. I think it's probably different if you weren't white and male and affluent, but. Orwell, of course, is a British writer, and he dies in 1950. So, he never got to see that decade come to fruition. However, one of the reasons I think it was so popular in Britain when it was published in 1950 is that the war, the post-war Britain, was a challenging place to live. They had suffered greatly through the war. Of course, they had bomb damage all over the place, and rationing that happened during World War II was still happening in the United Kingdom long after World War II was over. So we think of the 50s as a fairly sunny type of environment for the United States. That was not the case for Europe.
Does George Orwell get to see the results of his book? Does he get to see the sales of it? How are they in the beginning?
The sales are very strong in the beginning.
Yeah.
One reason I think 1984 is such a bleak narrative is that he wrote it in the Hebrides in Scotland, and he was there because he was having trouble breathing with all of the, we call it London fog, but really it's London smog. So he was dying while he was writing 1984. So that's one reason it's so bleak. But he had a very successful literary career before that. And I suspect he knew that 1984 was going to be perhaps his masterpiece. He was known as the Dickens of the Depression.
Really?
Yeah.
But his work is so much shorter than Dickens, and his writing is very different. So why is he known as the Dickens of the Depression?
Well, before World War II came about, Dickens really cut his teeth on Orwell really cut his teeth on jettisoning the sort of wealthy past that he was raised with, and he wrote Down and Out in Paris and London, where he actually became homeless in those two cities, and he wrote about that. The Road to Wigan Pier, where he wrote about what it meant to be working class in Northern England. And I admire him for this. He put his body where his politics were, and he went to fight in the Spanish Civil War. He fought on the side of the Republicans who were fighting against the fascists. And the Republicans in Europe are progressive. They're liberal. I mean, it's kind of a strange thing, which is a little different in American politics. And he wrote Homage to Barcelona because of that. So he had a long history of writing nonfiction. And then he returned to England during World War II. He had been shot through the neck during the Spanish Civil War. But in spite of that, he wasn't able to serve in the British Army, but he did. He was a reporter for the BBC. And so he had a long, long history of writing nonfiction and journalism. And then it was only really in the last few years of his life that he turned to fiction.
So 1984 is not the only book that's sort of seeing a resurgence of popularity. I've been watching, you know, advertisements for Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale being made into, I don't know if it's a Netflix special or a movie there, but that's something that's coming back. I think there's a couple other, I'm losing right now the title that everybody's reading right now. My brother was reading it too, and it's another dystopian. So what is it about 2017 that sort of makes us all want to read dystopian fiction from long ago? From these masters, because there's a lot of dystopian fiction being written right now as well. But we're sort of going back to these great literary giants like Atwood and Orwell to see what they had to say years ago.
This is one of the peculiar things if we think of young adult novels. There's a great popularity in dystopian literature already. You think of, now I'm blanking out, the Divergent series, for example.
Sure.
And, you know, Katniss Evergreen. I mean, those are dystopian novels. So, Hunger Games, thank you. And so that was always sort of popular with young adult fiction, you know, even like a decade ago. But there is definitely a resurgence now with dystopian literature, and in particular 1984, because George Orwell asked some really difficult questions about what does the truth mean? And in 1984, his main character, Winston Smith, is in charge of throwing things down called a memory hole, where if there's a piece of history that he wants to cover up, it's his job officially to cover it up. So the idea of government control and what truth means, I can see why this is a book that people are becoming interested in, because we currently have an administration that, you know, has talked about terrorist attacks in Bowling Green in Atlanta and Sweden, an administration that has talked about the very large size of the inauguration crowd, how millions of people were involved in voter fraud, and in particular in places like New Hampshire. And what we're being told, at least by the administration, is not jiving with facts. And we have a particular individual, Kellyanne Conway, even used the word alternative facts. And that is the day that 1984 really spiked on Amazon. So I see a direct correlation with what politicians are telling us and what the general public and investigative news sources are understanding about truth.
So is it cumulative? Because as we look back to some previous administrations and the use of language particularly comes to mind, I'm thinking of Bill Clinton with the Monica Lewinsky scandal when he was, you know, sort of arguing the definition of the word is, or what exactly do you mean by the word sex?
Yeah.
And so does that sort of build in our collective unconsciousness? And then someone like Kellyanne Conway says very directly alternative facts, and people who are literate say, well, that reminds me of Newspeak and Big Brother and 1984.
I think so. I think that's exactly what has happened. And, you know, I've taught 1984 for a number of years, and it always seems relevant, regardless of who's in the White House. I mean, we have issues of surveillance and Big Brother, and you turn on your phone and the government knows exactly where you are. So, I mean, these are ongoing concerns that 1984 nudges us to consider, but in my estimation, there's something else going on here where we have alternative facts and we have a president that says one thing where most of the nation would probably disagree. But certainly this idea of newspeak and how governments use language to sort of enforce policy.
Right. And the shrinking of language, the getting rid of words that can, you know, become thought violations or whatever we call that. So language becomes smaller and less adept.
Yeah.
So the power of language and even in math and science, all that's sort of in that book. What about the role of technology? Because you mentioned smartphones. I'm thinking about televisions and what you read about your smart TV being able to see in your house and what you want to do, listening to tech radio with Ken Osborne and hearing some of those things and going, I really hadn't thought of it like that. What was George Orwell's technological world that he could sort of look in the future and see some of these things coming true?
That, to me, is one of the truly remarkable things that George Orwell was able to do, because we look at 1984 and we see, ah, this is relevant to us today. But, you know, he wrote it in 1948 at, okay, there were TVs, yes, but, I mean, they were incredibly expensive and it was a rarity to even see one. And most people had a radio. So for him to be able to understand that television could be a two-way proposition, that it can spy on you as well as give you information. I mean, that is pretty extraordinary. And of course, you know, when he was writing it in 1948, I think it's good for us to remember that he was reporting on what was happening in the Third Reich and also in the Soviet Union. And in the Third Reich in particular, you know, people are disappearing. Technology is being used in very frightening ways. It was the Nazis that invented the rocket. They were very nearly the first country to reach space with the V-2. And with the Soviet Union, he was looking at how Stalin was purging people and, you know, actually erasing officials from photographs. So I think all of this sort of coalesces, and we get this remarkable gift to the future that Orwell has given to us.
Where does Ray Bradbury fit into this? I don't place him historically for me.
He came after Orwell, and of course he's largely an American figure, and he has taken science fiction and pushed it in a very sort of different way. I mean, he's like an icon of certainly American science fiction. Where with Orwell, I mean, I suppose you could call 1984 science fiction, and I certainly wouldn't quibble with that. I think that it is bigger than just science fiction, though. It's more than just a dystopian novel.
Let's talk about this. We've got to get to the rats a little bit, because there's this underlying sense of fear.
Yeah.
And it's and when you mention that he's writing it as his own life is ending, that makes sense to me, that there's this huge sense of sort of doom and terror. And in this case, it's embodied in the threat of torture.
Yeah.
But underneath it, there's this fear that you're going to let people down, that you don't have the courage that it takes to stand against tyranny on a very deeply personal level. And that's all woven in within a love story.
Yeah.
So explore that a little bit, because I'm just sort of reaching the outer edges of it. And you've probably contemplated it a lot, that notion of fear and impending doom in this book.
Yeah.
And love.
And love. Winston Smith does fall in love, and the concept of love is outlawed in the society of Big Brother. Sex is only to be used for procreation. And he does fall in love, and he is betrayed by the person he's fallen in love with, and he is taken to a place called Room 101. And anyone that's read 1984 remembers Room 101, because everyone that goes in there is terrified, and then they come out and they're a shattered human being. And we don't know what's in Room 101. And that's because Room 101 is different for every single person that goes in there. So Big Brother finds out what your deepest fear is, and that's what happens. And Winston Smith has always been afraid of rats. And this actually... Orwell served in, as I'd mentioned, he fought in the Spanish Civil War. One of the guys he served with was absolutely terrified of rats, which was bad news for him, because in the trenches of the Spanish Civil War, there were an awful lot of rats that were feeding off of dead bodies. And, you know, I won't go into the gory details about that, but that stuck in Orwell's imagination. So that's where the rat comes from. As far as I know, Orwell himself wasn't really scared of rats.
Right. One of the first books I ever read in seventh grade, I can't remember the title now, but it was a dystopian book about post-Cold War Holocaust kind of thing, and I just couldn't get out of my mind. It gave me nightmares.
Yeah.
And what is it about these books by Orwell and others that sort of resonate, regardless of the political times, but sort of stick in our minds year after year?
I think they continue to to nudge us with questions that are disturbing and maybe questions we don't want to think about, questions about human nature, about what you were saying earlier, Laurie, about doing the right thing and standing up and maybe being fearful of letting people down and having the moral courage to speak. And one of the things that I admire about George Orwell, he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, in times of deceit, it becomes a revolutionary act to tell the truth. And I can see that in 1984. And it's a reminder to me that often the greatest truths that we have are based in fiction, which seems strange. But I think we understand ourselves as a society when we tell each other stories that maybe aren't grounded in reality.
Patrick Hicks is the author of The Collector of Names, The Commandant of Lubezeck, and the poetry collection Adopted, and many, many others. You can find him online at
PatrickHicks.org.
Thank you, PatrickHicks.org. I didn't write it down. He is writer in residence at Augustana University. John Mollison is an artist and filmmaker and another one of our favorite guests. We put you guys in the studio at the same time. He is the host of Old Guys and Their Airplanes. He currently has a few projects underway, and one of them sounds a little bit like this.
Item 131, roll maneuver number one complete.
I'm waiting here. John Mollison.
You're waiting for the boom.
I'm a little unnerved by what might come next. So, John Mollison, welcome back to In the Moment. Can you tell us what we're listening to there?
You were listening to an LGM 30G made by the Boeing company.
And what is that?
Minuteman III ICBM.
All right. And where did you get that footage, that audio?
That audio. I got it at Vandenberg Air Force Base a couple weeks ago.
All right. So tell us about this project. One of these projects, you got a couple things in the works right now. Tell us what this is about.
Well, this is probably the most, I was going to say coolest, but that's been used so many times. Most interesting project I've ever worked on. It's a film on the missileers. And I think everybody appreciates that we have a nuclear missile force in the United States. But the people that maintain it, operate it, and are ready to deploy the unthinkable, those are people that most of us don't think about. And collectively, that's what they're called, is missileers. So I've been interviewing a distinguished missileer, the former head of the 20th Air Force, Major General Robert Parker, and learning about what it takes to be a nuclear power, deploy a nuclear defense force, and think about the unthinkable.
And what sort of things are you learning from the Major General?
Oh, geez.
That's a big question.
And we're just putting this together right now. We're in the middle of production of this episode. But I think the interesting thing that we learn when you're up against something as just heinous as the idea of nuclear war. And this was something that General Parker shared. He said, John, you've got to understand that we're all just people. We're all just people, whether we're in military or whether we're citizens, or we're a world managed by humans. And when you think about that, suddenly the idea of the commie aggressor or whatever, and you start humanizing your enemies, your foes, your friends, yourselves, you start realizing what a fragile world we live in and how much we need things like character and strength. How much we need things like restraint, but at the same time, we also need strength and force and the idea that we need to be strong to defend.
Where does character development come into the life of a missileer in a way that's different than anyone else in the military?
I've learned a lot to respect missileers. Typically, you know, old guys in their airplanes, I'm spending time with pilots or air crew. But missileers serve a different world. They're ready to deploy, but they never really, really act like an infantry person would, you know, SEAL Team 6 or a fighter pilot. A missileer is ready for a moment that he or she doesn't ever want to really happen. But yet, the whole point of their deterrence is that they're ready to do it, which to me is fascinating. So I'm learning about these missileers that they operate in kind of their own world. And I don't mean to give it a mystery, but they because of the nature of ICBMs and the whole idea of our Missile Defense Force, their idea of character has to be one of absolute integrity to their work. Absolute. And they need to operate without failure. Without failure. So the pressure to be an excellent missileer is different than it is to be an excellent fighter pilot. You know, you can make a mistake at 30,000 feet, fix it, and go, okay, well, I'll never do that again. Or, you know, you could accidentally drop a Sidewinder missile, you know, you'll never do that again. Well, missileers can't do that.
What is chain of command? How does that fall into this conversation as far as just obeying the orders and you know, trusting the people above you who are going to be the ones to tell you what to do and when?
Yeah, I think my experience in talking with missileers is that they are absolutely committed to their job. Mm. Absolutely. And thank goodness they are, because part of that safety mechanism, the processes that go into handling our nuclear arms force, you need to have people who are absolutely dedicated to command and control as well. So I've found nothing but the most impressive integrity with my dealings with the missileers.
Do they have to override their own hesitation at some point? Much of what you talked about before is character and restraint. At some point, do you have to override the sense that what you're about to do is really monumental and you're the person who is going to do it?
That's a great question, but I like to think about it, and this is mine, Lori, but there's a Bob Dylan lyric, you got to serve somebody, you know, it might be the devil, it might be the Lord, but you got to serve somebody. And I think with the missileers, I have met they have such a strong sense of mission and an understanding that their weapon system is the greatest weapon ever used. And by the way, the reason they say that is because it's used every day. That their level of commitment and dedication is unquestionable.
What do you mean by used every day?
That's a great question, too. And that's the title of our documentary, The Greatest Weapon Ever Used. By the way, I wanted to call it The Greatest Weapon Never Used, but
right.
The missileers corrected me right away. I thought it was really clever. You know, well, we've never used ICBMs. And
right.
They say, no, you got to think about the idea that we've had missile force as a deterrence.
Mm.
And it's been a terrific deterrence. When I was out at Vandenberg, when I saw the ICBM go off, obviously it was didn't have a nuclear warhead. And the time that they're used, they have to stay sharp in terms of the elaborate countdown procedures and getting the missile up and running and make sure that the fuel systems and the navigational systems are going to work. So they use them on a practical level, but you have to look at their use as a deterrence, which quite matter-of-factly, they've been extremely successful.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment. My guest is John Mollison. He's the host of Old Guys and Their Airplanes, and we're talking about a project that's currently in production, sort of still working around in his mind about the missileers. And John, you mentioned something about women and sort of the changing face of the Air Force. Tell me about gender in the missileer fleet, if you will.
Well, we're going to be interviewing a couple more missileers. I've asked that they be women. When I got to speak to the Air Force Association of Missileers this past summer, and two retired colonels who were females came up to me afterwards and said, you know, on your project, you'd better get the woman side of you. And they expressed that women have been a part of Missileers, and they want to make sure that the face of the Air Force moving into the future had the feminine side as well.
And that's something that you're pursuing then as well.
Yeah. We're going to wrap up filming here probably in about another 3 weeks. And then post-production, we should be done with this first week of April.
Excellent. What keeps them up at night? Are they thinking about North Korea testing missiles? Are they thinking about things like that?
Well, I don't think so. I've asked that question, and that'll get answered in our film. But I don't think they're thinking about, you know, threats, because it's not kind of that enemy type mindset of a missileer. I mean, they're not sitting there waiting with their hands on the keys. But what keeps them up at night, I could only guess, is issues like safety and readiness.
Sure.
Because when your mind is so much geared towards that 100% zero error mindset, those other ancillary threats like North Korea really become come nothing. Their job is, can we deploy? Can we deploy safely? Can we deploy effectively and do our jobs? Mm-hmm. I think what keeps them up at night is, can we be as good as we can be?
John Mollison, you always bring a good story. You're always working on the next great story. We've just got about 30 seconds left. Do you just know a good story when you see it, or do you have criteria and a structure?
I'm the luckiest guy in the world. They literally, they just find me. I don't know why.